This conference is being recorded.
Great.
So I sent an email just a few minutes ago saying I had a different code. So just ignore the one that I sent out. Just delete it. Because the code that I have is bad.
Okay. Well, it seems like folks here have got the right. So who we have here today, we have Michael and we have Michelle, and Tisha won't be joining us, but she'll be able to. And he said Bob will be joining us a little later.
I think that's what he
he sent an email saying that his meeting, I can't remember, got pushed up, or he's probably going to make it for part of the call.
Right.
He'll try.
Okay. Well, so our agenda today, I suppose our first agenda item, set our agenda. What do we want to...
Well, I'm thinking that we had two things. One was to talk about how we sort of ended at JSM was, do we want to put something together, as Tisha referred to also in her email, about writing something about the process of creating multiple choice items after open-ended items. And the other one is that we continue that process and from your suggestion, Dale, and start thinking about multiple choice items. Is that what you guys think, or anything to add, subtract?
Yeah, sounds good.
I think that sounds about right. I'd love to get kind of a big picture overview of what the goal or deadlines or plans are for the next year as well.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Well, I suppose one thing is to look a little more at just gotten on this process of trying to generate good test. We have responses from classes, and then we also got a few online that I sent around, which are fairly consistent with what we found in the classes, I think. What we should do is within each of our areas try to write up a couple of multiple choice questions based on what we know now. That would be one way to next time have some multiple choice questions.
I guess
I would say it. The multiple choice questions, I'm still a little worried about whether they will really do the job for us. If our goal is to gain a good understanding of the reasoning, part of the reason my thinking here is that when you lay out the multiple choices, that influences how people are going to think about it and what they'll tell you. That is, not have been thinking along those lines at all until the multiple choices, and then they kind of sort through and pick something. So does the test itself affect what we're trying to measure?
You know, did either of you guys review RPAS for Sharon Lane GTOS?
I'm sorry, review what was that?
Sharon Lane GTOS, after we met in Portugal, she had asked me to review the RPAS test. Did either of you guys see that?
Oh.
No.
Okay. So she sent out this document that was really great at going through her test and the development of it that was really helpful for me as a reader and I think was really helpful for her as a designer. Basically, for each question, she spelled out exactly what it's testing. For each distractor, she wrote up a little description of basically why she chose that distraction and what the misconception was. And I'm wondering if maybe we want to use that model rather than just saying to the group, you know, here's the multiple choice that I propose. Actually, you know, for each of the options, writing down what's the right answer and for each of the wrong answers, what misconceptions does it demonstrate? I think that would be really helpful to understand what we're getting at with the questions, and as Dale said, with the answers, and as Dale said, for the question as well, to maybe identify, you know, what is it really testing, and you know, and maybe that exercise, at least in my mind, might help identify what are we missing as well.
Right.
Does that make sense?
That sounds like a really good
idea. I think it's a good idea.
Was that in the article that she published from?
No.
No. Where is that from?
She
where did you find
the
paper
as an expert reviewer? I don't know what qualifies me for that, but as an expert reviewer of the RPAS before she revised it and sent out a new presentation and article.
Oh, okay. That's great.
Yeah. You know, and I can
Is that something
either
that you can
kind of
distribute
summarize
to us?
What she did to the group, maybe, and or ask her if it's okay if I send some of that out to the group.
Yeah, I expect she'd be happy to have the group look at that, too. I have a copy of it, too. No, I think that would be good. And that's, you're right, that is an interesting model of someone who's just done that trying to develop a test.
Right.
But I understand your hesitation, Dale, in terms of, you know, do the multiple choice really measure? Because when you see what some of their answers are,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, they get the right answer, but for completely the wrong reason when they have to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely does make you doubt.
And there also are quite a few different ways one can go wrong sometimes. It's necessarily three alternatives, you know. People come up with explanations sometimes that, well, frankly, I don't have a clue what they mean. I think, you know, you probably have to sit down with people and ask them to explain it. I mean, so the point is there's more information to be gotten than we have probably.
Well, so I wonder whether some of that information can be gotten by, you know, as is frequently done, asking the same question twice in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we only claim that they understand this if they get it right on all of the questions. That makes it a longer test. That makes it more work for us, but that makes it more reliable.
If one can make alternate question different in a key way that we can tell why they might get one wrong and the other right, you know, we don't want them to call, of course, or so similar they don't distinguish, don't give us new information. Well, but so do you think the next step would be to work at that and I think, as Michael's suggesting, writing out what exactly the item is intended to measure and what the distractors are intended to measure?
And what I think that's a good idea. I would like, if we can, also to take a step up, and I'm losing myself a little bit in the overall view here. And that once we have this test, how are we going to use it in order to say, you know, okay, this person, do we want to look at how well they did on all the questions up to the ones on sampling distributions, and then how well they do on the ones on sampling distributions, and try to figure out, okay, they can do okay on sampling distributions, but they did well on these two parts, but not this part. Or, you know, how are we going to kind of analyze the overall picture at the end, I guess, is what I've lost a little bit the thread there.
I mean, I think that was our overall goal, was to say, let's naively assume for a second that we can assess whether they get the preconceptions for hypothesis testing, or for sampling distributions, whatever we defined it for now at least. And then, you know, the people who don't understand sampling distributions, do they tend to not understand one of the other preconceptions more so than the others? I think that was our original goal. And again, assuming that we can actually measure whether they have mastered the material. Is that consistent with what you thought, Dale, or?
Yeah, I think so. I guess I'm also a little, I guess, what should I say, skeptical that we'll be able to actually pull that off. But if things would work out cleanly, we would have something like that. We would be able to show that our subscale, whatever, variability, in fact, is a critical predictor of people's performance on the broader, you know, using the sampling distribution or maybe beyond that hypothesis testing, so that we could relate errors in the later big concepts to errors in more focused problems or focus areas. But, yes, I agree. I think that's kind of what our earlier motivation was. And what I've learned from this so far is how difficult it is to measure any one of these concepts cleanly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was also looking through earlier the answers to the questions 13 and 14, which are the sampling distribution ones. And I'm still amazed at how many people for number 13, when you ask what the which graph represents the sampling distribution of sample means for samples of size 1, how many people put graph D, which is the one where there's only one bar?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which still, to me, still kind of hints at that it's not really there. In that, if you put D, your real problem is you have no idea what a histogram is supposed to be showing you. Like, they can't read frequency.
Right.
That.
Now, that's a good insight, I think, is that we assume when we lay out these histograms that people are interpreting them, you know, properly. But that example makes it really clear that some people, in fact, don't understand what we're showing them. And so they're answering a different question.
Should we add another category of, you know, graphical interpretation or reading histograms or something like that?
Well, it's crossed my mind a couple of times that it wouldn't be a bad idea because, but then, you know, I also go back and I look at some of the people, question 7, this is one of the ones on the standard deviation. You know, a couple people have said things like, well, the standard deviation, one person says they won't have it because, what did they say here? Identical spread, no, maybe it's not that one. It's question 6.
Which question is?
I can't remember. One of the two, 6 and 7 are the ones on standard deviation, where they also seem to be reading the bars of the histogram as values, because one of them said somewhere along here, I can't find it right now,
yeah,
but they all look the same. There's,
right.
There's not really any variation because they're all the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it comes out a little bit in other questions, but I'm wondering if it wouldn't be a bad idea to focus on that, or even if we had a question that focused on that was quite easy, just to sort of remind at the beginning of the test what a histogram tells you.
Yeah, or how to construct a histogram. Because we're assuming when we talk about distributions and shapes of distributions that are, you know, interpreting that correctly. In the chaos test, I think there are several questions that deal with interpreting graphs. I think it would be good for us to focus on that issue about interpreting graphs.
I think that's a really good point. I'll bet you there will be a very high correlation with if you can't understand a histogram, you won't be able to understand sampling distribution. Because it's just so inherent.
Right.
You know, although we have the same problem that, you know, Dale has mentioned a few times, that are we really measuring their lack of ability of understanding these concepts, you know, and how will we tease that out with their general, you know, intelligence?
That the same people who know how to make a histogram will know how to do other things too, and we could give them a geography test as well on sampling distribution.
Right.
But that, you know, that's okay. But if we can find some more precise relationship that people who don't know how to interpret a graph or create a histogram are particularly have more problems with sampling distributions. Understanding sampling distributions. That would be useful. We might say we need to pay more attention, make sure that people understand how to draw a histogram and what it represents.
Right.
What it represents.
And, you know, I'm thinking that if we do gather these data either on WISE or somewhere else, I wonder whether it's worthwhile to, even at this early stage, to stick in at the beginning of the survey a few demographic questions.
Mm-hmm. Something in terms of how many courses they've had.
How many courses you've had, gender, age. You know, one of the questions we can ask is for a self-assessment of intelligence or mathematical aptitude. You know, so if they're a college student, what was their math SAT?
Right.
You know, or ACT score, I guess. You know, I don't... We might have to think a little more about how to really phrase that, but, you know, my guess is even a self-reported measure of aptitude would probably be good enough to discern the relationship that Dale's talking about in terms of intelligence.
Yeah. and certainly interest in it. You know, how much they like this sort of thing or not.
Right. I mean, I'm imagining that we're going to get thousands of responses to this in order to tease out the relationships that we want. I wonder whether that's really true.
Well, between us, we should be able to get a couple hundred.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I'm not sure how many students Tisha has access to, but I think there's some other people that would be willing to give it a shot once it's developed, if it's something that's not too terribly time-consuming.
Right, and once it's well-developed, I wonder if we can put it out to, like, the EdStat email list and see if anybody else is interested and willing to do it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, the chaos test has some 10,000 people who have done it already.
Well, one of the things that was interesting with JSM, because I was doing a talk about the chaos test, a lot of people had a chat with me about it, and I talked to actually several people who said that they're not using it anymore because the students do so poorly on it, and because those who they're finding that the questions are just too difficult precisely because there's so many distractors in there, and they're saying that the students were finding it to be too long and too difficult, and as the teachers were getting fed up because their students weren't performing on it, so to try to use that for any sort of outside assessment measure, it wasn't going well because they just weren't performing well enough and they weren't seeing improvement on it. So that kind of rang a bell with me because I thought, yeah, there's sort of a fine line between how useful it is, and if the richer the questions are, the deeper they are, the more difficult they are, and can you measure a lot of improvement on this?
Yeah.
So I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, although I think it is getting at these concepts, underlying concepts, in ways that mostly people don't test. So just a thought on this is there, with that huge database, I wonder how much work has been done doing the kind of thing we're talking about here, looking at relationships between understanding or what the kind of errors people make on each item in terms of how it might relate to some of the other other concepts. I wonder if we couldn't what Bob's done with that data set.
They've done quite a bit, actually. Not so much correlating things, but they've done quite a bit of analysis for each individual question on saying whether the question was designed to identify a misconception or an understanding of something, and which questions showed some improvement, which ones didn't, why the ones that didn't, why they thought that they didn't, it was generally because they were more, the concepts were more difficult. I don't think they've done that much, or at least I haven't seen anything published that much about, how did the people do on this one question correlate to how they did on another.
Just to let you guys know I'm here.
Hey, Bob.
Oh, hi, Bob. Well, then you can answer that question.
Well, there's a couple of good things you're saying there, or interesting things. On number of distractors, have you guys ever heard that the optimal number of distractors is 3? Or actually, I think the way it's put is you do not need more than 3 options. So the correct answer in 2 distractors. That's adequate to get the information you need and gives you the most information you can get, as long as the 2 distractors are really good distractors.
Okay. From a pure psychometric perspective. But I'm wondering, some of these questions, there may be more than 3 wrong ways of looking at it. So
mm-hmm.
if you're interested in seeing exactly how people are going wrong, there might be more than 3.
Yeah, but I'm just throwing that out there to you, just to let you know that there's no
psychometric
reason that you have to have 4 or 5, however many distractors.
And in fact, it makes the question too difficult to read, and you lose validity. Or
that's right. But of course, it makes sense in certain situations. Now, another thing to think about is when you have a question and it has a bunch of different distractors, like 5 or 6, could you make it more readable by turning that into 5 or 6 questions?
True or false, or
valid, invalid, or correct, incorrect, whatever it is. But it depends on the nature of the question. But that can make that more readable. And then you consider those items as a set together.
Yeah, I think for some of the things we're dealing with, that may be a good way to go, good, because there are maybe more than three alternatives.
Yeah, but keep that in the back of your mind, that, kind of have an eye out for that. Then with respect to the difficulty of chaos, it is difficult. I just find it interesting that people don't say, well, I should find out what's difficult for my students and try to teach that better or give them better experiences.
Right.
It seems that some of the responses are, there is this response of, well, I'm not going to use it anymore because it's too difficult for my students. So I find that interesting. But
well, I think that, I think what they're getting at there is that anybody who is trying to use, not anybody, some people who are trying to use it as kind of an outside external assessment to measure improvement.
Right.
We're finding that it wasn't working out well for that.
I understand. Yeah, and I do
not
understand.
Not that it's invaluable in the information that you get, but it's not valuable for that particular purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to a couple people at Babson, they were saying it was really hard to get other professors to get on it and get involved in it.
Well, we've got a graduate student, senior graduate student, who's got a real strong background in IRT analysis for items, and he's working with a data set. We've got about 6,000 records now on students. That's actually a subset of the total number of records we've got. And one of the things he's going to look at is we had to figure out the dimensionality of it, of the test, and now he's going to go do IRT analysis and look at difficulty of items, what kind of spread we've got, and with the eye, and also look at differential item functioning, diff analysis on certain things, and with an eye to, is there, maybe could we cut the test in half and still measure the spectrum of ability, of knowledge? Is there a nice subset of these items that could be used? And not make it all just all the hard items, but is there a way we can spread it so there's a nice range of difficult and hard items.
Are you thinking of doing an adaptive kind of testing if it's online?
No, because from what I know of that, which is not a whole lot, I don't think we have enough items. I think you need large item data banks to do that, and items that are you need large numbers of items that are at the same
level.
They're not all at the same level, but
large number at every level.
At each level of difficulty, that's right.
Yeah. Now, have you looked at correlations among items, in particular, along the lines that we're thinking of working on our project?
You know, we haven't. We've done that from time to time, certain items that we think should be related to each other. And it's kind of looked at cross tabs of, we've looked at correlations. Well, one thing I can tell you is that the whole test has a nice high inner
Reliability,
right?
Yeah.
So that means that there's got to be, pockets of items that have pretty good correlations between them when you're just grading them correct or incorrect, 0, 1.
It'd be interesting with the scaling, you may be able to pull this out, but whether there is some, like a Gutman-type scaling, where if you get one item wrong, you're going to have, it's unlikely you'll get another particular item right.
We could look at that. I think what I'm more interested in personally is if they responded to this item this way, what's the likelihood of them responding correctly or in a similar way to another item?
Yeah.
And the ones I've looked at that seem to have some of that, and I can't pull off the top of my head, but they're ones that have to do with interpreting graphs.
Uh-huh.
Michelle, you know the baseball one, the batting averages one? That seems to be
in order to make it look by player to make it look like a symmetric histogram.
you manipulate it and you make a bar graph essentially instead of a histogram, and that seems to be related to a couple other items. People who make the choice of that bell-shaped looking item do make other erroneous choices, but not 100%. It's not a one-to-one mapping, but there's a greater likelihood it looks like to me.
Well, we were just talking about before you came in, and the one that the items that we have at one of the two sampling distribution questions with the new data set that Dale has come out with, that a lot of people are still answering that for sample size one, the graph that looks like the sampling distribution should be the one with only one bar.
Uh-huh. That's right, and that's actually where I...
That they can't read a graph.
That's where I came in. And so I kind of heard and followed your conversations about adding in some other items or to get at, can they interpret a graph and some of the demographics and that. Sounds like you guys are going in some good directions. There's an article in the latest issue of JSE, of the Journal of Statistics Education. I think it's the first article. Authors are Cooper and somebody, Sarah Cooper, I think. I just read through it. And it's about, can students at the end of a stats course interpret graphs? And you guys might be interested in looking at it. It's not too long of an article, 10 to 15 pages, something like that. And it's not a great article, but I think she gets at some interesting things with it.
Okay.
So you might look at that one.
That's on the one that just came out?
Yeah.
The one with the NSF stuff by Gingerell and...
I think that's right. Well, okay. That might be the previous. I can't remember. I know that this is the first article.
We'll find it.
It's volume 16, issue number 2. That's what I recall.
Okay. Pretty good memory.
I just read it the other night. So.
Yeah. Well, but that's an interesting sort of broader concept of how instructors are liable to assume that their students know some things that the instructor is very familiar with, that if the students don't know, the instruction using that will not make much sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we can be talking about these graphs and the students aren't interpreting that correctly. It's very confusing, no doubt.
And I'm sure I don't need to really say this, but because you guys realize it, but what you've been talking about seems 100% consistent with your overarching question of kind of what are the precursors of understanding sampling distributions and hypothesis testing and such. And the reason I brought up that article is that she doesn't test this directly, but they make statements about if they can't correctly interpret a histogram, then what happens when you come to sampling distributions and we're asking them to interpret these distributions?
Or even the explanations we're doing on the board or where, however, drawing mm-hmm. these things out and waving hands over it, talking about it, for some, apparently, that is this problem we learned to correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to back off the conversation here and let you guys get back to it, but I'll chime in if I hear something.
Well, that's very relevant. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
But pertinent to that point, then I think in our little test we should do something more explicitly on graphs, you know, understanding mm-hmm. your graphs, because I think as Michelle pointed out, you can see that showing up in a couple of places actually, where people get wrong answers.
And I know Tish has brought it up frequently as well that she thinks a lot of problems for students have just with understanding with the histogram. So maybe we need to just try to find a more explicit question that focuses on that.
Yeah.
And it largely gets down to trying to read what do the axes represent? Before you talk about that kind of issue, when they say the sampling size 1 should look like the 1 bar, means that they're just not paying attention to the axes. So something that focuses on the axes, because we do have some questions about the shape and the spread, but we don't really have anything that looks at, do they actually get what is on these two axes?
Yeah. Just simply asking, you know, what does the number 6 on the horizontal axis mean, or something, you know, or what does the 6 on the vertical axis mean?
Now, I remember seeing questions like that somewhere. I don't remember where it is, whether it was Chauncey or whether it was something that we read where there was a question about, you know, there's two different. I don't even think they were histograms. I think they were just graphs with X's, saying you do the X's and these. But I can't remember where that was. Does that burn a bell with anybody?
Yeah, I don't know.
Two histogrammy looking graphs. And one of the questions was, do these two circled X's or whatever they were, do they mean the same thing? No, that doesn't ring a bell.
I don't remember, but yeah, if we can locate something like that, probably be
okay.
Helpful.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I'm thinking maybe something to, as a next step moving forward, would be to work on our questions, taking what we've gotten now from a number of student responses of how they go wrong on it, to see if we can work up either multiple choice or if we need to have maybe multiple true-false or Likert or something scales. But to try to get it in a easier to grade format, easier to work with.
And I like, Michael, your idea before, as we do this, especially if we're each working on different questions, trying to write out why do we justify why we have this distractor, justify why this is the right answer. Because I think it'll help us both in creating those distractors and if we have to write clearly why we did it, and also sharing them amongst ourselves would be a lot easier.
Help to make sure we cover the range of things and that we say don't overdo one issue with ignoring others.
So should we set that as a goal for our next call that we
And maybe
try that?
The next call even to send around drafts of it so that at the next call we can, you know, talk about it.
Okay. I agree. I think it's nice to do some of the work offline because we can't get as much as we need accomplished if we're all together.
Okay, that sounds good. So shall we set a date by which we want to try to have them circulating? I guess we could set a date for our next call, too, even though we're not done with this one yet. But.
Well, let's see. So we're maybe in a couple of weeks, 3 weeks or so, and then we'd have a week before our next call.
Okay. That sounds good to me. What's the date in 3 weeks? Because I don't have my calendar set in front of me.
So 3 weeks from now is October 1st.
Okay.
Yeah, so by the end of the month, by the end of September.
Okay.
If we say the September 30th, it gives it a little more urgency than if we say October 1st.
Okay. Okay. And should we each try to work on that for the questions that we were focusing on before? That makes sense.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good starting point. And then we also should work on coming up with some questions on graphs, too, maybe, interpreting graphs.
Are there any graphs other than the histogram that we're particularly interested in?
Maybe stem and leaf plot, but I think we are focused on the histogram. I mean, looking at our...
In the chaos test, there are some questions using the box and whisker,
and
it could be that some people just don't understand what they represent either.
Well, but this should be specific to our test. So if in our test all we're using is the histograms,
you're right.
Then let's just test the histograms.
Yep.
Yeah, that's.
And we can, you know, if they understand box plots or not, that should be irrelevant. Maybe correlated with whether they understand histograms, but irrelevant for our test.
For our test, that's right.
Okay.
We do, I think the biology psychology professor is a box plot, right? Or is that just data now?
I think it's a dot plot, isn't it? What is it?
Oh, that was, yeah. That was
kind of it's a dot plot.
A dot plot, yeah. But there too, I suppose, is a question if people understand clearly what that represents. You know, it seems it's so intuitive. It may not
the answers here, the answers that they're giving, yeah, they seem to understand... That each dot represents a single score.
Yeah.
So that doesn't appear to pose some difficulty in answering the questions. All their questions, sort of, all the answers are focusing more on the spread and a little bit on the average, but they seem to understand more or less with the dot test. I would say that one seems to be easier than the histograms.
Yeah.
So I'd go with focusing on histograms.
Yeah, I think so too.
Okay.
Well, let's see. Should we, while we are close to talking about dates of things, plan a next call? I didn't print out or look at what Tisha said. Do you have that? Anybody have that handy?
I have it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, to be consistent with her.
Go ahead, Michael.
Mondays after 3, Tuesdays after 3:30, Wednesdays after 3, on most days, Thursdays after 3:30, Fridays after 3.
Okay.
Basically any time after like 3 or 3:30 Central Time.
Okay. My schedule is very flexible. I'm on sabbatical, so you know, I'll leave it up to you guys to pin down. What are some constraints here? What day would you prefer?
I'll join in with Dale. I'm on junior sabbatical, too, so the only issues for me are going to be the Jewish holidays.
Okay. So, Michelle, what works best for you?
I would like to do it before October 13th is my big thing, because October 13th I start my PhD classes, and I'm teaching three other classes at the same time. So
well,
if
we
can
could do
it
the week before or in the week of the 6th.
The week before would be good. It's the
so
week
the
8th
and the
9th
are no good for me.
Okay, not the
8th.
Would you say the 7th would work for me?
Is the 7th a Tuesday?
Yep.
All right, well, should we go on Tuesday? Tuesday is free after
30 Central.
Oh, and
so should we say 4?
Half an hour later than this.
Yeah. Why don't we make it 4? Because if she's busy till 3:30, then that gives her a little leeway.
Okay.
So 4 Central, 5 Eastern, 11 Monaco.
2 Pacific.
Okay, 4 Central would be 2. So that's the 7th of October, Tuesday, 2 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern. What was it, Monaco?
11.
11 p.m. Okay, yeah, 9-hour difference for me. Okay. Bob, that works for you?
Yeah, actually, it will work for me.
Okay. And do you know about Andy at all?
He may be teaching at that time. I don't know his. I know that Tuesdays and Thursdays are his big teaching days, and he's got 3 or 4 different classes he's teaching. I'm not sure which it is. So it's likely he could be open, but it's likely he's going to be involved. I get done teaching at 3:45, so I can be at the start of the call. And trying to remember. Actually, Andy might not be teaching at that time, because I think I usually see him then when I'm leaving about 5:30. He's going over to his next class. But he's gone now. That's right. I was supposed to say he's with his dogs. He had dog duty.
Uh-oh.
We had a meeting that went till about 3, and then he was heading straight home to catch that. Just email him, you know, the information, and he'll either be able to participate or not.
Right. And for Tisha then too.
Yep. And when you email her, I know you guys will do the minutes and that, but I was just thinking that September 30th date you had for something.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to just inform her of that right away too.
Yeah. Right.
Good idea. You think if we don't tell her till October the 2nd, it'll
well,
be a little tight?
How often do we
get our minutes out the week before?
I thought you were going to say if you don't tell her till like September 28th or something. But I was going to say, actually, that tends to work well for me.
Right.
I might be more likely to get it done under that pressure, you know. But whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, who will send out a note? I mean, anyone else can do it, but we should make sure somebody does.
Who's doing minutes?
Let's see. Where are we here? So September...
Hopefully not Tisha.
It's Tisha.
Is it Tisha?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'll send it out then. I won't send out minutes of the whole thing, but I'll send Tisha a quick note at the end of our call tonight.
Okay. That'd be great. Yeah. So we'll see whether she really listens to the recording, I guess, if we get minutes.
Okay.
Just remind her she was supposed to take minutes when you send out that email, Michelle.
Okay, I will. And we can say hi to Tisha right now, because when she does listen to this recording,
great.
Hi, Tisha.
That's great.
So the second thing that we want to talk about was the possibility of putting together an article on this process. Is that right?
Right.
I think that's a great idea. Targeting like JSE or something, is that the idea?
Yeah, I would think. And we want to go through the process of developing multiple choice conceptual questions, going from open-ended to multiple choice. Is that?
You know, you guys could also consider the StatEd Research Journal, SURGE. It's kind of a methodology type. It's kind of like a, it's part of doing research.
Mm-hmm.
And they might find it of interest.
Yeah, the content as well as the process.
Yeah. So don't, so I would go look at what they are looking for in articles, but I think you would fit into one of their categories.
Okay. And for something like that, Bob, for the search, for to do a literature review for that, would it have to be a literature review on test development then, rather than kind of literature review on the concepts that we've been looking at?
Well, I would think, you know, a person in measurement would tell you that you need content experts when you're developing items for a test, and you guys are content experts, I think, arguably. So, and literature on these concepts then would also be relevant. But yes, you should be looking at literature on test development, on psychometrics, things along that line. I don't know that I've got anything.
Would Andy be a good person to ask?
You know, Andy would be a very good person to ask about that.
Should we make him a verbal comment as well and see if he listens to the recorder?
Did you hear that, Andy?
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Andy.
But why don't you give him the courtesy of an email also? Because he might be able to suggest some things to search on as well as provide some actual references for you. I can't remember if any of you were at his, at the session Joan organized on assessment.
I missed Andy's part. I think he was the first.
He was the first
speaker.
And another thing that came to mind is, so I think things he said there probably is relevant. He and Michael Rodriguez, who's one of our resident measurement experts, they gave a webinar on this stuff last spring, I think it was. So you could go up to CAUSE and look for a webinar that Andy and Michael Rodriguez did together, and that might be useful to view that half hour.
Okay.
The dissertation on our past development also probably has some references in it.
Yep. Sharon, that's a good one.
Dale or Michael, have either of you read much up on this or done much on this before, as far as measurement goes? I know Michael even looked that direction, but I don't know if you've had time to do much
not
with it.
Not really
either. You know, I mean, we've all been involved in making tests, but not that kind of formal test, I guess.
I think it would be really interesting if we could find some literature studying, basically demonstrating that good multiple choice questions are just as effective of measuring ability as compared to open-ended questions.
You will find that if you go look for it. You will find that. And why don't you actually pose that to Andy directly? Because I know Michael Rodriguez, if you go view that webinar, I'm pretty sure you'll see in there that statement. You usually can get more information about the students with a well-designed multiple-choice test, not with just any multiple-choice test, and all the other benefits of more straightforward to score, more objective, and so on.
Yeah.
But you can write good conceptual items that are multiple-choice items, and they're usually more objective and more informative than the corresponding. It's because one of the things is you can have more items, you can get more information than in the corresponding open-ended test, which is going to be limited in the number of items that you can have. And
the open-ended ones are often confounded with people's choice of how much they'll write and how
mm-hmm.
clear they are. You know, when you look at some of these open-ended responses, they're very cryptic, and it's really hard to tell how much the student knows or what they know.
Yeah. So I don't know how much is out there, but I know that literature is out there for sure. So that's a good question, Michael, too.
And I can tell you, because I just checked now, I did have a vague memory of seeing that webinar, and in fact I did. It was on November 13th, 2007.
It was last fall, that's right.
And I'm looking through towards the end to see if they have any references, which they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, there's nothing to see. I've got the PowerPoint slides here. I'll send you all around the PowerPoint slides from it. And then we can ask Andy for some references. Okay.
But and then we have specific things like that one Michael brought up about comparison of
demonstrating multiple choice.
Yeah, of free response to multiple choice or you know, multiple choice to other things, you know. Make sure you fire that to him specifically. And he'll either know or he can go. Michael Rodriguez's office is basically between mine and Andy, so we can
find
it.
Oh, he's at your school as well.
He's at our school, yeah. He is one of our measurement experts.
Is the one you were talking about before the guy who was, I think he came to our group presentation, the one when we were, all of the research clusters were presenting, and they asked a question about how we're going to measure something.
No, that wouldn't have been Michael, because he was not at JSM.
I think that was one of your grad students, one of your...
Yeah,
that was Jehoon, and
that's
the person doing the IRT analysis. You're exactly right.
Okay.
So that's what
you're
referring to. What's that?
What was his name?
Jehoon Roo. He's Korean,
mm-hmm.
And J-I-H-O-O-N is his first name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and R-H-O-O, I think that's right. I'll have to go look that up. It's R-H-O-O or I-Y-O-O. I can't remember right now.
Well, Michael or Dale, would either of you be willing to put an email together to Andy with those questions?
Sure. I didn't make real good notes here. but, yeah, unless you want to do it, Michael, either way.
I didn't take good notes either.
Okay, well, I took notes, so I'll do it.
I was going to say Michael, but Michael's got the specific question,
yeah.
So he knows that one.
Yeah,
I can take it. That's
mine.
Yeah.
I'll just
stop
for the recording to minute 50 and
right, yeah, right.
Remind myself, that's fine.
Well, yeah, but the basic question you have whether multiple-choice questions can be as good as open-ended or are as good as open-ended.
And there's some literature demonstrating that.
Literature demonstrating that, or what are the...
Yeah, but then you're also wanting some literature on item development and good procedures for item development and so on.
Maybe if you've got something on true-false as well would be relevant because it could be turned into true-false.
There's a lot of literature out there on that, too, and especially on what's called multiple true-false items,
uh-huh.
The thing I was talking about earlier on.
Like in one little domain.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you have in the CAS about the different p-value interpretations, valid, not valid?
Exactly. Yeah, chaos on p-values and also confidence intervals. We've got that
right. One
like that, too. And I think if you went to Google Scholar and searched on multiple true-false, that would give you hits.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, I think I've got a folder. We're working on an article where a lot of stuff is relevant. I think I have a folder of PDFs, of articles all having to do with multiple true-false. Would you want me to fire all those files off to you guys?
Sure. You want to zip it up?
I think I'll zip it up. Yeah, it'll make it more likely to get to you guys. That sounds good.
Great.
That would be great.
Okay.
And another question that I thought about when if we're writing this article, can we tap you and I don't know, possibly Joan and Beth also for some input and ideas when we get going a little bit, since the three of you have been through this whole process at length over the last couple of years to do the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
You can share some of your experience as well.
Yeah, I think we'd be willing to look over drafts, you know. That might be the way to do that.
I would also pose the question, I haven't really done group writing like this before. And the question for me would be, anybody have any tips on how to accomplish it well?
I can jump in, and since I've done a bunch of group writing, our method is someone says they're going to take the lead, and they write, in a sense, a first draft, but the first draft might also have just sections that have headings with nothing after them.
Placeholders with somebody else.
Placeholders, right. So it might be someone, you know, takes it, kind of sets up the outline. It also might just start with an outline, and then various people say, well, I can tackle this or I can tackle that. And then there's just a logic that usually happens where you've got to develop certain parts before other parts, maybe, you know.
Right.
And I keep hearing people say good things about Google Docs for doing this type of thing.
Okay. I guess the first question for us, if we're going to pursue this, would be who wants to take lead on it? And I don't know if we want to answer that now or mull it over or what.
Well, I can say now that I can't take the lead on it this fall. I know for sure, because I've just got too much going on with three classes plus my own class, taking classes. And I've done something similar to what making an outline and filling in some parts. I did that a little bit, I guess it was before JSM. And I don't know if I ever sent it to you two. I sent it to Tisha to come up with her notes, but I'll send it out to you for starting the lit review of the concepts that we've been looking at. So I've written up a section on variability, although it's not particularly good. It's at least something down that I'll send out to you. But we can mull it over, but I just can say now I know I can't.
You know, another take on this is you guys try to identify the different parts of the paper, and then, because I think there's a couple different literature reviews, at least, that you guys are talking about. There's the concepts, there's, you know, maybe misconceptions, there's also the measurement literature, and maybe there's some other ones, you know, in there. You guys have done some already, but there's some new stuff. And that might be another way of divvying up the task, of person saying, I'm going to go find what I can on this area, and I'll try to summarize that. That can be a good start.
For me, biting off a small piece would be much more feasible.
Right. Yeah. It would be good, though, to have somebody take the overall lead of seeing that it gets done, you know, getting them out there and so forth. I know, Michael, are you interested in doing that?
Maybe.
Maybe? Okay.
You know, I'd love to wait. We haven't.
Yeah. Well, we should get Tisha involved.
Tisha would be interested in doing. You know, I don't hear any of us kind of jumping at the opportunity. So.
Well, maybe Tisha will.
You know, for me,
did
as I said before.
Did you detect hesitation in my voice?
And it sounds like you've got some more literature to look at, too.
Right.
And you, yeah, and
I mean,
you guys.
If we get someone to write the outline, maybe divvying up the tasks after that of, okay, one of us do literature searches on this area and the other,
That's true.
Might be helpful. I'm trying to, keep my eyes focused on my methodological papers as well and try and get those out because that's what I need for tenure.
Right.
So I'm trying to stay focused on that goal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, we're reaching close to the end of our allotted time. What we got planned then is in the interim we're going to work on writing up some questions in closed format, some of our open-ended questions by the end of the month. An email going out to Andy from Michael. We've got an email going out to everybody but Tisha in particular from Michelle.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sending you an email now with the slides from the webinar and with the lit review part that is done already.
Great. Right on the spot.
Okay. Well, perfect.
Okay, and our next call then is on Tuesday the 7th of October. So I've got that settled.
Exactly. And we get the things out. Now, do we want to send – we can put stuff up on the Google Groups, but – If we put anything up, can we let each other know by email? Because I have to admit, I rarely ever go to check the Google group.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. Does anyone know whether there's a way to do kind of the RAFS feed or something so that anytime it's updated, we get an email that says it's been updated? Does anyone?
I don't know that,
but I wonder if that's a question maybe we can ask Justin.
I think that would be a good question for Justin. But and you might just take a few minutes. It might just take a few minutes of searching just up at Google Docs too. So you might just take a look.
All right, I can take a look for that.
Okay, there's Google Groups and Google Docs. I've never used Google Docs. Have you guys ever used it?
Oh, this sounds more like a Google Groups type of thing when something gets posted.
Yeah, I meant Google Groups.
Yeah.
The thing that we've been doing.
Right, okay. Okay.
Yeah, all righty. Well, good. I think we've made some good progress. Got to, I guess
glad
we're ready
you could
to
make
sign
it, Bob.
On. So good talking to you all, and it'll be within a month, and we'll have some stuff going on.
Okay, that sounds good.
Sounds good. Looks good. Looking forward to hearing you guys again.
Thank you, everybody. Good luck with your sabbatical projects as well.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.